You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
It's Sunday afternoon, March 24th, 1991. Crystal and Bruce Dennehy have just realized that their four-year-old son, Michael, has vanished in the middle of the afternoon. It's broad daylight, and he's vanished from a playground in their quiet, safe, little Vancouver Island city of Victoria.
Good evening. It's every parent's nightmare to look away for just a second and find that your young son or daughter has disappeared. A couple in Victoria, British Columbia is now living that nightmare.
I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Island Crimes Season 3, Missing Michael. Episode 2, Hellcats. In this episode, I'm focused on those early hours after Michael vanishes. What is happening on the ground? Literally, on the field. Michael disappears just before Crystal and her football team, the Hellcats, are about to begin their game. The Hellcats are teammates, but they're also close friends. And what happens on this day will forge those easy young friendships in a deep bond that transcends tragedy and time. In a video taken around that time, a young Crystal Dennehy is wearing leopard print black and white shorts, a red Hellcats pinny, and a stylish feathered haircut. She's laughing and huddling with her friends. To understand what happened on the field that fateful Sunday, I've talked to as many Hellcats as I can. Corrine Timmerman is a Hellcat and a longtime friend. In 1991, she's in her 20s, working for the provincial government, living downtown and enjoying her life.
I met Crystal and Bruce when I was playing football with Crystal on the Hellcats. And so I was with Crystal and Bruce on the morning that Michael disappeared.
Cheryl Miller is also a Hellcat in 1991. She's in her mid-20s, beginning a career as a teacher.
I met Crystal through our football team. So we have a mutual friend that decided he wanted to put a women's football team together. He played on a men's team. And so he asked Crystal and I to play on this brand new women's football team that had never played football before in our lives. And it was at the football field where Michael went missing.
And there's Nova Lee.
My name is Nova Lee Tinian. I've worked with the Correctional Service of Canada for coming up 30 years, and I was playing football with Crystal at the time of Michael's disappearance.
And Kathy Brown.
I played on the same football team as Michael's mom, Crystal.
Joining and playing organized sports was a way to really meet a number of really great friends and continued friendship. We're a pretty close-knit team that did a lot of activities together, from, you know, camping to, you know, barbecues to other social events.
Before you knew it, we had this great core group of girls that were, they're just lovely. Like, they're, yeah. When we played football together, it was our whole social group. Skied in the winter, camped in the summers, you know, went to everybody's weddings and baby showers and all that kind of stuff. So we were really, really, really close.
We did everything together. We were together all the time. We always had, you know, we did parties and barbecues.
We were close. We'd practice at least once a week. Then we'd go out for dinner and always cocktails. We're always involved. It was fun. It was always fun. It was like Sundays was our day at the field.
We were just looking for a fun physical activity to do. You know, you don't wear gear or anything. You're basically running with flags taped around your waist that people pull off. They're all attached with a Velcro belt. Yeah, and once we started, we really liked it and just continued playing and just got better. And I mean, we were super terrible at the beginning. Really, really terrible. We didn't even know the rules. You know, we had to learn how to run a pattern. We had to learn how to catch a ball. But that was part of the fun of it, too. You know, we were all learning together. Maybe that helped to develop our friendships. Crystal was the first of our friends to have a baby. So Michael was sort of, yeah, the first for all of us.
And he was brought to practices and games, and everybody, yeah, everyone treasured Michael. He was the first.
Michael becomes a beloved part of their football family.
For me, it was really nice and interesting to see just them being a family. You know, they were always doing things, or with Michael having, you know, play dates and barbecues, and he was always coming along to wherever the events were, and, you know, just was kind of a bit of a center for them, you know, kind of doting on them, right?
Crystal was just a very competent mom, just very calm and really, really good with Michael. You know, strict, you know, he didn't have a lot of freedom. He was well-loved, and he was a sweet, sweet little thing.
Very happy child that was just, you know, obviously getting doted on. So with everyone else being one of the youngest, you know, first one to have children, right? So yeah, just always seemed to just be, you know, happy, happy-go-lucky.
We would all just look after Michael, like he would sit on a blanket with us or whatever, like we did with any of the kids, like as more of our friends had kids.
The afternoon of Sunday, March 24th, the day Michael disappears, all of these women are on the field and about to become a part of an unimaginable tragedy.
It was like almost any other kind of morning. It was nice out. It was just kind of getting organized and getting ready to head to the field and trying to get there a bit early. Yeah, it just was almost like a regular kind of Sunday morning, getting organized to go down to the field and meet up with the team and get ready to play.
I had to line the game before we played, but I live fairly close, so there was a game before and I was lining, and then I forgot something, so I had to run home and get, I don't know, whatever it was, whether I forgot my cleats or my uniform, I can't remember, but I did run home and come back. And the weird thing, and I, like when I drove into the parking lot, I was a little bit late, so I was sort of rushing. And I remember looking up and seeing Bruce with Caitlin, holding Caitlin, just walking by the school. And I remember saying to myself, oh, there's Bruce and Caitlin. I wonder where Michael is.
You know, that field was not that far from where I was living. So I got out of my car and kind of grabbed my stuff and was making my way down to the field. It's not that far, but you just have to walk across part of a field to get to where we were playing. So by the park and just down. Definitely some kids there, just did a quick look up, and then I think it was just to the left of where I parked is where the playground was, and then I just kind of made my way down to the field. Some were there. Crystal and Bruce were not there, or Donna were not there yet, but a few of the folks were there already. So kind of went down and we're just starting to chat a little bit.
We had had a party the week before, 2 weeks before. It was St. Patrick's Day, right? And Donna and Crystal and Bruce had showed up, and where they parked, I was starting to walk towards them, and Bruce had Caitlin on his belly, right? And he was walking towards the field where the game was going on, because I think they had just left Michael. Michael wanted to go play in the park, right? So Donna and Crystal were walking towards me. Bruce was beside Crystal, right, walking with Caitlin. And I stopped and chatted with Donna and Crystal because I had the I had pictures from the party, and I was showing them the pictures.
Warming up, I don't believe we were even actually playing yet. And I remember that Michael had asked to go to the park, and I just remember seeing Crystal talking with him, and then he went to the park. I didn't see him actually go there. I just know he did.
I just want to go back to something you said. You saw Crystal talking to Michael?
I believe I did. I don't think I'm making that memory up.
You might be the only person who I've talked to who actually thinks they saw him.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been a glance. I would have just looked over. I didn't study them or watch them, but I feel like I saw her talking to him, yes.
A game in progress. Two more teams arriving. The parking lot is busy, more than three quarters full. The small playground sits about 200 yards away from the field where Crystal's teammates are gathering.
We just kind of got down to the field and you just start chatting and everyone starts arriving. And so we were starting to get organized, getting, you know, everything kind of your bag down and unpacked because everyone kind of arrives all around the same time.
So before the game starts, we always do a warm up.
Yeah, just stretch, get, you know, if you had to tape up anything, you know, it was flag football with touch rules, so it wasn't contact. But yeah, just kind of making sure that we were all kind of, you're there, you're stretching, you know, running a little bit just to make sure you don't injure yourself.
And then, the moment, everything changes.
Bruce was bringing down Caitlin and all of her stroller and stuff, because at that time she was 6 months old, and Crystal was there, and then I think somebody asked where Michael was, and they said he was just up at the park, and that it was the first time they were having him at the park, and that they were basically, Bruce was just dropping the stuff off and then walked straight back to the playground.
Michael's dad came and said, I can't find Michael. So we instantly stopped exactly what we were doing and just started looking for him in the field, the school grounds, and the park, and the like everywhere. And I remember just my girlfriend and I were looking together, and we just looked at each other and went, this only happens in movies. This is not real.
Bruce must have come and said, Crystal, called Crystal away, and then she came back and said, guys, we can't find Michael, we need to go look.
And that's when I saw Bruce. He was walking towards Blanchard, towards like the donut shop. And I think it was Crystal or Donna said, hey, can we just take a few minutes? Michael's, you know, we can't seem to find Michael, right? And we never played our game.
It was really quick. I mean, I think he came back to say, you know, like right away, kind of ran back to say, you know, that he couldn't see Michael. So everyone dropped their stuff and ran up to search right away. Because sometimes, you know, kids that get can be a little bit mischievous, I think. So we were maybe just thinking that to start. I would say it was in a matter of minutes that we had our entire team looking, as well as a team that was going to play against us, looking. And at that point, then I think when we realized he was missing, they stopped the other game and everybody went to look.
We were sort of pointed in a direction to go look because they thought he had wandered off and maybe he went with a friend or like a new friend. Yeah, so we just split up and scoured the neighborhood, calling his name and screaming his name, basically.
If I recall correctly, there was another little boy playing in the park, son of another person on another team, whose son's name was also Michael and had blonde hair. So it caused a little bit of confusion at first when people said, no, we got him, but it wasn't like we found him, but it wasn't Michael. It was the other Michael. I would say it was in minutes our team had started to look when we realized it was a little bit more frantic. I would say it was like within 10 minutes, there was folks starting to, you know, stop in the game and starting to kind of look beyond even kind of the area and going into more of the neighborhood.
I was still in my shorts and I believe I had my flags on. We still had our uniforms on. And we just started going, knocking door to door, right? And where the school was, there was like a housing complex, right? For low-income families, right? And I kept on thinking, you know, come supper time, you know, somebody will find an extra kid and they'll, he'll get booted out. And, you know, we hung around that area. Where did he go? He just kind of vanished into thin air.
By now, Bruce and Crystal realize the police need to be called. This is the time before cell phones. Bruce spots a man mowing his lawn across from the school and asks to use his phone. The field is not far from downtown Victoria, and the police arrive quickly. The hunt for Michael escalates.
I mean, I think at first we just kind of thought, okay, he's just maybe like any child wandered a bit. And so everybody was, you know, urgently looking. I think there was the point where it became probably a bit more frantic when kind of recognized that it was more serious. So at one point, we were just kind of looking in the area, then the police did arrive. And there was a community center close by, and they opened up the doors.
Police begin coordinating search efforts, assigning areas to be checked by the growing number of people arriving to help scour the community. Here's how Cheryl remembers the neighborhood at the time.
It wasn't a great neighborhood. Low-income supportive housing along Blanchard Street. A bunch of apartments in behind that, you know, were lower rent. Lots and lots of little kids. And that's why we sort of thought, well, maybe somebody said, hey, Michael, do you want to go get a drink of water? Or do you want to go, you know? And so maybe he went with one of the kids. That's sort of, you know, what we were thinking might have happened, you know, even though Michael was told he wasn't allowed. You know, he was only four.
I probably stayed till midnight that night looking just in garbage cans, knocking on doors. Yeah, we would look in people's sheds. We would look under their houses. We knocked on doors. We looked in garbage dumps, garbage cans, anything that could possibly hold a child we looked in.
We all spread out and we start searching for him. I do remember meeting up with Bruce on the corner of Cook and Hillside, and I think he was talking to a police officer, and I said, you better call the ferries, like close down the ferries.
We looked, like we walked around neighborhoods and knocked on doors and you know, peeked in backyards and knocked on trunks of cars and yeah, just walked through the neighborhood for hours and hours and hours. I was so frantic.
The women recall residents of the neighborhood responding with care and concern. Yes, this is a community that is down on its luck. But the searchers meet with no resistance as they begin their door-to-door inquiries. But once the police arrive, the fear and anxiety and tension begin to ratchet up. Even in those early hours of the search, Corrine recalls the police trying to get a read on what they were dealing with.
I remember they asked me specifically, were both parents there? And were they both the biological parents? Because a lot of times in disappearance, it may be a parental dispute. That was one of their kind of first questions I recall them asking me. And we weren't even in the community center. It was out on the street. So I think they were just kind of getting getting a feel for some information, right? When they realized that that was the case, then it became, I sensed a little bit more urgency. You know, by the time the police arrived, I would say it was probably more frantic for everybody, just because realizing that it was everybody, you know, our emotions started to get to you because you were just a little bit more on heightened, like, what the heck's going on, right? Little Victoria, right? Like, nobody really expected anything to kind of happen, right? It was, you know, kind of what I would call maybe back in the day more of a sleepy little town, right?
The perception of Victoria as a sleepy little town is one I will hear again and again. But this sleepy little region has multiple municipal police forces and several RCMP detachments. The police officers I speak with will talk about how busy they were then and now.
I do remember going home and stopping at a donut shop because the Esquimalt police were in this donut shop. So I went in there and I told him that Michael had gone missing. He knew exactly who Michael is because he knows Bruce and Crystal. But you know Victoria, there's five different police jurisdictions, right? But they have all different departments. So, and that was in 91. I don't think they were communicating, you know, with each other properly at that time. You know what I mean? It was just like a nightmare, right? Like,
much is made of the extent to which all of the police forces in the area worked together on Michael's case at the outset. But I also occasionally hear questions raised about whether the fractured jurisdictions may have hampered the investigation. But no one is asking those kinds of questions on the night of the 24th. That night, the focus is 100% on finding Michael.
At that point, they were sort of thinking that maybe Michael was trying to go home, you know, walk home because he was scared and he didn't know where anybody was. So I'll just go to my house. And Crystal said that she felt he could walk home if he needed to. He knew the directions. I think we were still out walking around looking for Michael until like 1 o'clock in the morning. We were just so frantic. We were just running everywhere. Like, horrible. And the thing that I remember that I think in hindsight, nobody thought it was an abduction. Everybody just thought he had walked away.
At one point in time, when it started to get dark and started to cool off, I remember heading to my parents' place to pick up some warmer jackets and some flashlights that they had for us to search into the evening.
And I just couldn't leave. Like, I felt like if I left, I'd be letting him down. And it was dark, and we went to a donut shop at like 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock, whatever, I don't know. We met up there and chatted. A lot of people had gone home, but a lot of people had stayed. And it was just, I felt great amounts of guilt leaving when I did, but I mean, you have to, right?
Through the night, I think it was about 2 or 3 in the morning that I came home for a rest. I lived downtown, and I think it was, I had fallen asleep, and I think about 5 or 6, I could hear the helicopters, because at that point they had also brought in helicopters to kind of search from the air, and I could hear the helicopters kind of coming back and forth.
By that evening, more and more volunteers are joining the search. Posters with pictures of Michael are printed and distributed so people will know who they are searching for. Up next, word begins to reach friends and family beyond the field, and a young detective is called in to help.
For most of us, crime is something we see on the news. We never think it could happen to us until it does.
Loved ones are gone, and for the survivors, the scars will never heal. I'm Nancy Hickst, a senior crime reporter for Global News. And on this season of Crime Beat, I'll take you inside some of the most serious crime stories I've covered. Season 6 of Crime Beat is available now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and all podcast platforms.
Sunday, March 24th. Michael has now been missing for hours. The police have been called in. Community members are joining the search as word spreads that a four-year-old boy is missing. It's 1991. This is Victoria, an island city. Just about the last place you might expect a child to disappear.
Oh, God. I still remember, like, the day even getting the call. Everything about it was just bizarre. Okay, my name is Glenys Russell, and I met Crystal back in 1985, before she had Michael, and we started a football team together called the Hellcats. She's a few years older than us, kind of the grandma of the team, even though she was probably only 23, 24 at the time.
Glenys recalls the good times she shared together with the Dunahys young family.
So Michael was born in May, and then almost 2 years later in February, I had my first child. And it was just fun. We lived in Victoria at the time with my first husband, and they would come over, and we only had a little two-bedroom house, and they would put, Eric would be in her crib, and I had a little twin bed in Erica's room, and they would put Michael into sleep in there so we could visit, because I was like way out of town. Like back then, it's not way out of town now, but it was out in Millstream area where nobody lived, and that's where we had bought. And so they'd come out and visit us and bring Michael when he was little, and they were just fun people. We did a lot of stuff together as a team. We did a lot of camping trips. We used to go up to Duncan and play, and because Michael was the first kid in our group or whatever, he was always part of pretty much everything we did. He came to football tournaments with us. He was just, I don't know, I'm probably gonna start crying.
The friendships, the bonds made through the team are tight. The tragedy of Michael's disappearance colors those memories bittersweet. But Glenys still recalls the joy of the game itself.
So I loved it because it was in wicked shape, and it was a team thing. It was fun to do.
Because Glenys is so close to the Dunahy family, it is devastating for her to experience this tragedy from afar.
It was horrible. You just can't believe it. He's going to show up. He's going to show up. He's wandered off somewhere. You can't do anything.
Glenys' parents are still in Victoria, and they lend an early hand in the search efforts.
My parents owned a logging company, and they had a whole bunch of Vancouver Island helicopter hours. So, I mean, my dad donated those instantly, and there was, you know, to have the helicopters up there looking, because, of course, they knew Bruce and Crystal, too, right? We would have, they know them before I was even married, right? Because I was only 19 when I met Crystal, and I think she was 23 or whatever, so we would have parties at our house on Gorge and that, so they knew Crystal and Bruce very well, too, and they knew little Michael, and it seems so weird that it just went, nobody saw anything, like, fuck.
Glenys wasn't playing that day, but she shares some very specific memories of the field itself.
That was probably my least favorite field to play, and not to stereotype, but there's some pretty scummy low-light, you know, rentals around there and that, but it's kind of busy there right on Quadra, too, so it's not as picturesque, if you will, and then there's like all the sort of townhouses and everything all around there. Just kind of run down, like a little bit run down, if you will. I don't know. Like I say, I don't even think I've ever told anybody that. But I guess if you were in a great big, you know, we're a place with a lot of fields, some of the other places we went to, it would have been virtually impossible for anybody to grab him because you wouldn't have had any sort of buildings around either, right?
Thinking of the field, recalling that unsettling period of time also brings back memories of Michael.
I think the biggest thing I remember about Michael wouldn't be so much games or practices. It'd remember, like, we'd go up camping to Duncan every year. The Duncan used to have a big May-long tournament where teams would come over from Vancouver and everything, and our team would all camp. He was just there. He was just this little, and I've always liked little kids, so even though I would have been younger too, he was just, he was a good little boy. He would just sort of, you know, toddle around the campground and, like, with us all there. Like, if we were sitting around, you know, visiting in the morning, eating our breakfast before the games, he was just, you know, I can picture him, like, if it was a little drizzly, he'd have his little rain jacket on. And it's just, he was just had a very good, mellow, cute little personality. Just picture him with his little blue eyes, and his little hair would get all messy up on the top. And he was just like a little boy, like everything you would think of, like a little boy, just plucking around. And he was very good. Like, I don't remember very few times Bruce and Michael not being at the games watching us play.
And not once does it ever occur to Glennis, at the time or down the years, that anyone she knew could have been involved in Michael's disappearance.
100%, 100%. At no time did I ever heard of any of our group of friends or anything, ever think it was like an inside job. No, it's it would be somebody that nobody knew. It was just like, who could have done this? Never wondering, was it someone, you know, related to them or someone that we knew? No.
I'm John Ducker. I retired from the Victoria Police in 2013 as the Deputy Chief of Police. And I was one of the investigators on the Dunahy case, although a very junior investigator at the time.
John is born in Victoria, raises his family in the community, and is now retired there too. Watching old archival tape of the Dunahy case, John stands out as the police officer with an impressively thick mustache. In March of 1991, John Ducker, a young investigator, is called in to assist in the case.
I was working in the sex crime section at that time when the Dunahy file came in. And every detective in the Victoria Police Detective Division was assigned to the Dunahy file.
It's early in his career, but he's far from a rookie. By 1991, John has worked on patrol and in squad cars. He's done a stint in traffic. He's been a dog handler. He is in the sex crimes unit when he is assigned to the Dunahy case.
Got a call from one of these senior sergeants who was in charge, a guy by the name of John Smith. He said, we're calling everybody in. This looks like this kid has disappeared under unusual circumstances, and we need everybody to come in and start working on tips.
John remembers getting to work as quickly as he could and remaining on the job without a day off for almost 3 weeks.
Every detective, you know, whether they were working in fraud or sex crimes or major crimes or whatever, was on the file. And a number of patrol people were seconded up to the second floor detective office to, you know, work the phones. And then also at the same time, there was a capacity organized at the patrol level to, you know, coordinate ground searching and to thoroughly and physically scour the area where Michael had last been seen. It was definitely an all hands on deck. We've never really dealt with something like this before. You know, we had to ensure we were making a maximum effort.
In those first few days of the search and the beginning of the investigation, he describes how Victoria's police force tries to manage what will become one of the largest cases in Canadian history.
The protocol at that time was using what they called a tip system. And there would be some officers staffing the phones, and the tips would be, this is before, you know, computers became mainstream in policing. So there would be tips that came in and were carded, literally with carbon paper cards, and then they would go into a bin, and you know, people in charge would apportion those cards to people, and you were given files to work on based on those tips. And everybody had a handful of tips, and we're to start follow-up investigations and track down whatever information was alluded to on these tip forms.
This is 1991. Computers are just becoming more commonplace in offices and homes across Canada. The Victoria Police will get a new computer system in place to try to manage the flow of information on the Dennehy case. And while this may seem like a dreary little piece of administrative detail, it really is key. This file is ballooning, and tips are already beginning to become unmanageable. I asked John Decker to think back and try to recall the nature of the tips that were coming in those early days.
Right. Well, they, you know, there were, you know, a number of suspicious vehicles seen in the area at that time, you know, a brown van, a green and sort of yellow van, or a brown car. You would go and see if you could track down this van. And then there were names of people that, you know, members of the public thought might have been suspicious. They saw this guy in the area, you know, so you would have to go and try and find these people and interview them and get a sense if they were involved in anything.
That brown van that John Decker mentions will become one of the biggest leads in the investigation. The true value of that tip is unclear, but as this and other tips roll in and word spreads, it becomes increasingly obvious that the Dennehy case will be challenging to coordinate.
Well, bearing in mind that it was still a manual system, so there was a lot of meetings during the day to kind of coordinate what various people were working on. But I mean, it was pretty clear from the outset that this was going to be an overwhelming file. There was a lot of effort made in those meetings to make sure that we were trying to make as good a progress as we could make in terms of not duplicating efforts and understand what everyone else was doing. If anything became more than a little bit suspicious, then these were raised up to the senior sergeants and the detective staff sergeant and the inspector in charge to make sure that you know, the more seasoned investigators were put on those to try and run them to ground as quickly as possible.
It's an intense period, with everyone aware that time is not on their side.
There was a lot of pressure in that period because you know, there was a great sense of you know, the clock was running down here, and you know, from experiences with other jurisdictions, that you know, you have to really move hard on these things within the first 72 hours. And so that pressure was very evident. And based on the national and international media exposure and the amount of tips that were coming in, it was, you know, there was a lot of psychological pressure there for sure to try and get through as many of these things as you thought were possible. You had to still do a very thorough job and not try and overlook anything, which is difficult when you're trying to move fast. So that was my sense of it, that you had to move very quickly, but be as thorough about things as you possibly could.
And so in those early days, John is following up on tips.
We had to go out into the neighborhood and speak to a lot of people. So there wasn't hardly any video recording like you see today. So there were a few of those, and those surveillance systems had to be looked at. But there wasn't very much of that at the time. But so mainly it was interviewing people, and if they were suspected in any way, trying to establish an alibi for where they were at the time of the disappearance. It was a lower working class neighborhood. was an old neighborhood of Victoria, older homes. It was a high call load area for patrol people. A lot of social issues around domestic assaults and kids hanging around and petty thefts and things like that. But still kind of a strong neighborhood in its own right. I mean, I know that there are lots of people who have lived there all their life. I mean, I think mostly people were more than willing to help. It was, evident, at least on the surface, that people understood what was at stake here and were cooperating, and they were allowing you to look in their yards or look in their homes if you asked to do so. And the detective function is a little different, rather than kind of just searching around. It's really establishing that. I was here, I was working at this time, and then immediately getting on to the employer or workmate to confirm that the person was actually there.
Thirty years on, John Decker is still hoping that the right tip will finally lead to answers on the file.
There's two things that I always think about. Is one is that there's going to be that phone call. There's going to be that discussion that joins two tracks together, and the light bulb will go off, and there'll be a lead. And the other thing I think about is that who's ever involved may have a change of mind, or more particularly a change of heart, and make the call or write the letter or leave it in the will or something bizarre like that. That'll open up the pathway to finding out what happened. So I believe Michael's still around, and I'll never give up that belief until it's proven otherwise.
John Decker was feeling the intense pressure on the police in those early days of the investigation. And that pressure was also being felt by the Hellcats. I learn teammates are asked to go under hypnosis.
We were all hypnotized to try to remember something.
Oh, wait. Okay. I had not heard that detail before. Tell me about that.
So we all went down to the police station, and I don't remember how late it was after it happened, but a group of people that they felt were driving into the parking lot right around the potential time Michael went missing. We were hypnotized. And for me, I don't think I fell under hypnosis. There was no groundbreaking anything.
But so who's doing the hypnosis?
I don't even remember, but it was someone through the police. Huh. So the police department had someone come and hypnotize people on the team.
I was heading towards them, towards the parking lot and where the playground was. They tried to hypnotize me to see if I had anything in my subconscious, but I couldn't get hypnotized for whatever reason. They couldn't draw it out of me. I couldn't recall it. And yeah, and I don't remember it. And I didn't remember it then, and I don't remember it now, right?
I know I went under hypnosis. I know a number of my friends did as well. Yeah, it was the first time I've ever been under hypnosis. And it was really just trying to recall any details of the route, starting from leaving at home, the route down to the field and getting out of your car, and what you might have seen or not seen.
The Hellcats are not just possible witnesses. As you have heard, these are people who are close to the Dennehys.
I mean, they questioned all of us. I can't recall the 30 years ago all the questions that they asked, but they did. And I would say that I guess maybe it was 5 years ago, they requested to have another interview with as many people that were there. So I know I went down to the police station here in Victoria, and had probably about 2-hour interview with them. So they did interview all of us, you know, at least from the close circle, but I'm not sure beyond that if how much further they would have gone out. There wasn't anything at that time that would have said, what the heck is going on with anybody. There wasn't anything that kind of triggered anybody for having any concerns.
For those who know and love Michael, that pressure, that trauma creates a lifelong link.
We kept playing. You know, we stayed together for Crystal, I think, you know. In some ways, it brought us closer. You know, we needed to be there for Crystal and Bruce for the support. You know, I think Crystal needed a positive outlet with her friends. And I think the football in itself was something positive just because. And I think it was good for Crystal to be able to run and play and do something that was, you know, sort of fun. Well, you don't have any words to even say anything to Crystal and Bruce, you know, like you just hug them. You know, I go to the walk every year and I cry every year. You know, what do you do? It's so unfair and so hard.
Crystal's probably the strongest woman I know, so it probably bonded us together even more. You know, we took some time off from playing as a team. You go through some numbness, and then I think you just try and figure out how to support each other. But then we regrouped and kind of came back. But I think it probably bonded our friendships more so. And you know, even, you know, 30 years later, you maybe don't see everybody as often, but you're still in contact with pretty well everybody.
You know, when you have those friends or whatever, and then you can go 10 years, 15 years, and then you can see them and it's like nothing changed. They're just very easy. Bruce always calls me Rosie. It's an old story, but you know, when I've seen them, you know, he's like, hey, Rosie, like, and they had a very nice kid. Like, they have a very nice kid. I mean, he's being an adult now, but he was just the nicest, nicest little boy. Like, they were good parents. You know, when I've tried over the years to make it back for the Michael Dunne runs and stuff, or if I'm going to Victoria to coordinate a weekend where I can take part in that, you know what? At least once a month, this crosses my mind. What happens if they never get answers? I just pray that whatever the outcome is for Bruce and Crystal, they get an answer before one day they die.
Well, I just think the strength of Crystal and Bruce, and I know that's probably already evident, but they were incredible, and we just loved them so much, and I just wish for a positive outcome.
You know, we were Crystal's family for a long time, and she was part of our family for a long time. Like, we have, you know, growing up, that was our little group, and you know, it meant a lot to all of us.
To this day, Crystal's friends support Bruce and Crystal in keeping the hope alive that Michael will someday be found.
You know, you have to hold out hope. There's nothing to indicate not to have hope. There are stories that you see where, you know, children are found after many, many years. And, you know, I think, you know, you do need to keep that hope alive.
I do believe he's alive, though. I just do. I really do. I think so. I think so because I just sort of really believe a mother's intuition. I just think because she believes so strongly in it. And I don't know, I guess I'm very superstitious myself. And when I really believe something, it usually happens. So I just, when I have a feeling about my own kids and that, I'm usually right.
She knows in her heart that he's still alive, like as a mom, you know, that connection, right?
Maybe one day Michael is going to do one of those DNA tests and find out that he is who he is and not who he thinks he is. And that's how I like to think things are going to end. So yeah, I still hope.
During my conversation with retired Deputy Chief John Decker, he reminds me he wasn't the lead on Michael's case at the time. He was a junior, and that I should try to speak with the investigators who had conduct of the case over the years. And so I do. And in the episodes to come, you'll hear from three of the leads on the Michael Dennehy case, beginning in episode 3, The Investigation with retired detective Sergeant Don Bland. But first, a word from one of Michael's heroes.
Michael Dennehy loved the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Back when Michael was a little guy, loving the magic of the Turtles, I had the privilege of being the voice of Michelangelo. I'm Townsend Coleman, a voice actor, and one of the many people who want answers in Michael's case. The Turtles were crime fighters who believed in justice. If you have any information about Michael, please head to michaeldunahy.ca and click on the Report a Tip button.
I'm Laura Palmer, and you're listening to Island Crime, Season 3, Missing Michael.